So the last verse, which we looked at last week, gives us an entry into this first very long section. It's the longest attempt by Paul to comment on a scriptural text. It's his longest exegesis of it, and it's quite beautiful. But the key line that leads him into it is verse 6, the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. And I did give you a handout last week on that, and let me sum up the point again to get your consciousness with it. He's not saying the law kills and the Spirit gives light, life. He says the letter kills. But it is in the context, as we'll see, of the law. So I think a correct understanding is to say the letter without the Spirit can't give life. Only the Spirit can give life. Jesus says much the same in John's Gospel, if you remember. The flesh is useless. The Spirit gives life. So the Spirit meaning God's. God is the source of all life. So the Spirit that comes from God is the life-giving thing. And the law, without the Spirit, can't give life. And when he says the law, the letter, kills, he means the law, without the Spirit, not welcomed by an open heart, kills. The death comes from our stubbornness, from our blindness, from our inability, perhaps, to follow the law. So I'll take that as read from last week, and then he bursts into this particularly beautiful section. But the whole section depends on you being familiar with a magnificent scene from the book of Exodus. So I'm giving you a summary of it here. It's chapter 34 of the book of Exodus. We've just had Moses going up onto the mountain to be with God and to receive the Ten Commandments. You're familiar with this. And he's up there 40 days and 40 nights in a mystical prayer, as the story is dramatically presented. So downstairs, the people are getting a bit sick and tired of this. Where's he gone? He's disappeared. He mayn't come back. So they ask Aaron to give them a god to follow, remember? And they make the golden calf, which becomes a symbol forever of heresy and apostasy. So they make this golden calf. Moses, you remember, comes down from the mountain, sees it, smashes the Ten Commandments. How am I going? I'm not as good as the actor in the film or whatever. But he smashes the Ten Commandments, and then he goes up to God, and God's going to destroy them. And he's pleading with them. And then we come to our section. Come up, says God, in the morning to Mount Zion, Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. Then there's a few more verses. Then the Lord descended in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed. And there's a few more verses. And then there's this wonderful passage. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for the thousandth generation. Thousand was the biggest number in Hebrew. You know, we're into trillions now, but a thousand was their biggest number. So whenever they say something is going to be a thousand, they mean it's as far as you can count. It's the limit. So forever and ever, till the thousandth generation. That text becomes, in Exodus, is like a creedal text of God, because you find it seven or eight times through the Old Testament literature, in the book of Tobit, book of Nehemiah. It's all over the place. This comes back again as their hymn of praise of what God is like. Slow to anger, merciful, gracious, etc. Now we come to our scene. That's verse 5. Jumping to the end of chapter 34, this is what happens. Moses comes down, and Moses did not know that the skin on his face shone because he had been talking with God. So picture it. Moses is up there with God for 40 days, and he comes down, and his face is radiant like the sun from God. Brackets, little distraction, but it might help you. Have you ever seen, for example, if you've been in Rome and seen the great Moses in the Church of St. Peter in chains, he's got the horns, and in case you don't know why, the Hebrew word used here for shone is karan. That's the verb, karan. Now, keren in Hebrew means a horn. Karan means growing horns. Literally, growing horns. When Jerome in the Vulgate translated karan, he put cornuta, that is, his face was horned. What we know now, which Jerome didn't know, brilliant scholar that he was, but you know, he can't know everything, is that karan was also used, this is through discovery of language, metaphorically for rays of light, like a fawn or horn coming out. So now the new Vulgate says resplenderet, resplendent with light, and that's what it means. So now you know why you see pictures of poor old Moses with horns. It's from this exact text here. But it means he radiated out light. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, the skin of his face was shining, and they were afraid to come near him because the glory of God shining. Why are they afraid? Because you cannot see the face of God. You can't come close to God if you're in sin. Do you get it? Sin and God don't work. So it was like if you look on the face of God, you will die. You've even heard that in some of the scriptural texts. It's metaphor, but it's... So here's this radiant light, which is divine, coming at them, and it's blinding them and filling them with fear. What's God going to do to us? Will he burn us up? Will we be destroyed because of our sin, you know, with the golden calf? Anyhow, it goes on. Moses tells them what God said. Then it says, when Moses had finished speaking, he put a veil on his face. Because he's got to live with them now. He doesn't want to... They've had to be blinded for a short time, but then he veils his face to make it easy for them. But whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would take the veil off until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, the Israelites would see the face of Moses, that the skin on his face was shining, and Moses would put the veil on his face again until he went in to speak with the Lord. Hold that scene in your mind, because that's everyone knows that scene that he's writing to. That's exactly what you're thinking about when you start to read what Paul says now. The ministry of death, if, he says, Paul, I haven't got it all there, I'm just reading now from Corinthians 3, verse 7, if the ministry of death, chiseled in letters of stone tablets, came in glory so that the people of Israel could not gaze on Moses' face because of the glory of his face, comma, New Revised Standard Version, a glory now set aside, comma, how much more will the ministry of the Spirit come in glory? Just go that far. So if that happened, how much more this? I have to tell you, because it can happen even in the best of translations, I'm confident in telling you that the now is wrong. Firstly, it's not in the Greek. It's been introduced into the translation by the authors because they're making a comparison between what it was like then and what it was like now, that Christ has come, do you see? Old Testament, New Testament. And that comparison is there. But because now is not in the Greek, we shouldn't put it in, because actually I think they're missing the point. What our author is talking about is it was veiled then. You know, we've just read it. Moses had to cover his face then because they couldn't look on the glory of God. So leave the word now out. It was a glory set aside. How much more will the ministry of the Spirit come in glory? Go back to here. Ministry of death. Why does he... See, remember he's writing to basically Jews and Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians who, you know, know about the Bible, obviously. So he's writing to them and he's trying to encourage them to stay in their faith. It's a ministry of death because of the hardness of heart of the people who built the golden calf, who didn't listen, who refused, whose heart was hardened against the revelation of God. He's not blaming the Ten Commandments. He's not blaming the Old Testament. He's not blaming the Torah that came from God through Moses. Of course he's not. He thinks it's beautiful, and it is. But he's saying, in fact, it brought death because people didn't let it in. He says it's chiseled in letters of stone on the tablets. Don't take that negatively. It's not meant to be a negative statement, because the tablets of stone are meant to be a symbol of permanency. You know, if you just write on something else, it can go off. But if you're etched into stone, means God said it, it'll never change. And we've still got steles, haven't we, from Hammurabi, 1800 BC. We've still got the law of Hammurabi on a stone. It lasts. So... no, this is a permanent word of God, but it's a ministry of death because people didn't welcome it, didn't live it. Came in glory, okay, we've seen that. A glory set aside, he says, and he's going to play with this. He's not going to go back and give the original meaning of the text. He's going to use it in the light of what he knows. I've probably said this to you before, but pardon me if I do again, because it's such an important insight. Well, I found it an important insight when I got it anyhow, so I hope you do too. I grew up thinking that Isaiah, say in 740 BC, somehow foretold Jesus, a prophecy. God inspired him to know something that was going to happen in nearly 1,000 years. And he foretold it. And so when you get to Jesus, he fulfills the prophecy. Are you with me? And by fulfilling the prophecy, it kind of shows the consistency of God's word, and that what Isaiah said, here's Jesus doing it. 1 = 1, you get me? The mathematics is complete and you can know this is it. I want you to see it another way, because it really is important. Prophecy is about the present moment, always. To prophesy means to speak from God, to speak forth, pro fermi in Greek, to speak in front. To speak like I'm speaking now, but to proclaim and prophesy are exactly the same word. One's Latin and one's Greek. To say out loud what God is saying. And you're always talking to real people. You're always talking about their situation. You're also talking about their future. So the prophets will often say, if you don't do this, this will happen. But we do that too, don't we? If we go into Iraq, and you know, we're not all right and we're not all wrong, but we've all got fears about it, and they're not unbased on anything. So people are always seeing the effects of present action. So the prophets do that, of course. But you'll find, read them again and again and again, you'll soon find, whenever they talk about the future that is not linked to anything now, they're never about us. They're always about God. They're always about the lion will lie down with the lamb, and, you know, the Zion will be this. And they're about whatever we do now, even if we don't listen now, or do listen now, God will always be God. So grace will always be there. The future, you know, whatever the future, that will always be graced. God will never stop being God. There'll always be a chance for repentance, and so on. Statements like that. But they're never historical statements about foreseen events, because you can't foresee the future. The future is clearly based on random, but a whole lot of interactive, free choices made by people. It can't be foreseen. Okay. So our author then is not, so we're back here with Paul, he's not reading that text I just put up for you for before and giving the meaning that the text has. He's not doing that. He's not saying this is what the author meant when he wrote Exodus 34. What he's saying is, hey, go back and read 34, you Christian community, and when you look at Jesus, you'll see meanings in it that are consistent with it, but that are more beautiful and more transcendent. So he's kind of using the text to help us see what we can now see if we look at Jesus and see that it's consistent with our ancient texts. It's a very different thing from what a modern scholar rightly would be trying to do. I won't say this again. Remind me, I have, if I ever try to do it again. A modern scholar, and it's a wonderful thing, is always trying to get back to what did the original author have in mind when he wrote it? Why? What did the original hearers or readers understand when they read it? Why did they keep it? Do you get it? Why did they see it as inspired? So we're trying to get as close again to the mentality of the 8th century before Christ. Well, if you try to do that, whoever wrote this is not talking about Jesus. He's not talking about the new law. He's not talking about the transfiguration. Do you get me? He's talking about his world. And he's talking about Moses having to veil his face. He's talking about the fact that the people, because of sin, can't look on the face. Only the pure of heart can see God. The sinful can't. They're afraid of this mystery of light. So they have to be veiled. God has to somehow protect us from ourselves by veiling his face, even the radiant face of Moses. So our author then, if you can take that on board, is using this story, but it's wonderful. And then he goes on now to talk about comparing it to that. Look at what we've got, he says to the Christian community. Now I'll read the whole text. I've just got a few bits of it there. How much more will the ministry of the Spirit? Letter kills, the Spirit gives life. The ministry of the Spirit come in glory. For if there was glory in the ministry of condemnation, you shall not kill, and if you kill, this will happen, etc. How much more does the ministry of justification abound in glory? Indeed, what once had glory has lost its glory because of the greater glory. For if what was set aside came through glory, much more has the permanent come in glory. Language is very abstract, but he has said four themes about this new, and the ministry he's talking about is Paul's ministry. Moses' ministry was to give the Torah. Paul is to give the good news, the gospel. So he's comparing himself to Moses. Not saying he's better than Moses, but saying what he's ministering to them, the gospel, is more than they could get from the Torah. And what's he said? Firstly, it's a ministry of justification. Big word in Paul, simple word enough. And those of you who have computers these days, many of you probably do, you can more readily get the meaning. To justify a text is to get it level on both columns. You know, because mostly if you just type, it ends up, doesn't it? And if you can go click and it goes like that and spreads it out so that it looks neat. To justify is to adjust, to get it right the way you want it. Well, justification is God lovingly getting us right, purifying us from sin, changing us, ridding us of the effects of sin, purifying us, sanctifying us. So that's justification. In other words, bring us into communion with God. There's no other way to get right. Secondly, it's a ministry of the Spirit, which is already said in earlier verses we did last week, written on the heart. Now, tablets of stone are permanent, but they're out there. The heart is here, the delicate, fragile, beautiful thing that we call the human heart. That's where the law is written. We've accepted it. We've drunk it in. The love of God has been poured into our hearts by the Spirit given to us. So this is more tender, more human, more inside, internal. It's a greater glory and it's permanent. Greater glory. I take you to another text. This is not Paul, but it's Luke, who was a disciple of Paul, and his gospel is called by the early people the Gospel of Paul, because these two were very close, and whenever you read Luke and see any differences between Luke, Matthew and Mark, invariably you find the differences are very close to Paul. So there's a close connection here between Paul and the Gospel of Luke. And you know this scene, but it perfectly fits our context. About 8 days after, Jesus took with him Peter, John, and James, and went up onto a mountain to pray. Moses went up onto the mountain to pray. Jesus goes up onto the mountain to pray. While he was praying, the appearance of his face changed. His clothes became dazzling white. Not unlike our scene from Exodus. Suddenly, they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, speaking to him. This is a drama. This is mystical experiences which Jesus is having and they're having. You think of all the lovely mystical experiences you have daily. Well, a mystical experience is, what is it? But if you try to dramatize it, you've got to realize it. You've got to make it look, you've got to put it on stage. You've got to somehow bring in the music and bring in the poetry and bring in the images that somehow, in between them all, try to communicate something that's quite incommunicable, an internal experience. Isn't that what poetry is doing? And all the arts are trying to communicate something that's so intimate and personal that you just can't say it, but you've got to try. Well, here they are saying something, and look at the words. Moses and Elijah and Jesus. Why is Moses there? Exodus 34. Moses is the Torah, the law. Why is Elijah there? 1 Kings chapter 19. Elijah went up onto the mountain of Sinai, remember, 40 days and 40 nights he wandered, and when he got to the end, he went out into the mouth of the cave, and he looks at this vast thing, and then he covers his face with a veil. And God says, you cannot see my face, because Elijah wants to see the face of God. We all want to see the face of God. You cannot see my face. You can only see my back. It's really cute. And God comes by, and only when he's over there going that way does Elijah get a glimpse, which is pretty good, isn't it? We get a glimpse of how to follow. We get a glimpse of a disappearing mystery. We get a moment, and then it's gone. But we know we've got to walk this way. We know the way, the Torah, that's what Torah means. We know the way, but we can't yet see the face of God. All that beautiful stuff is happening. So here we have the law and the prophets on this mountain and Jesus in the middle. And what happens? They appeared in glory, radiant. And they were speaking of his departure. The Greek is exodos. They were speaking of Jesus' exodus from this world into the mystery. And he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Now, says Luke, Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep. Every time you see them, they're asleep. Hanging in the garden, they're weighed down with sleep. How are you all feeling? All right? And you fall asleep. So, okay. So that wait, but since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. Just as they were leaving him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it's good to be here. Let's make three tents, tabernacles, dwellings. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He didn't know what he was saying. Here's the climax. While he was saying this, a cloud came, the veil. Cloud doesn't mean one of these cumulus things. It's the cloud of unknowing. It's the whatever it is that makes it impossible for us to see God. Because we're veiled, God isn't. But we can't see directly. So the cloud comes and overshadows them. And they were terrified as they entered the cloud. Then from the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my son." Psalm 2. The trumpeted psalm of the coronation of the king. "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." I could say a lot more about this, but it would take me too far afield. It's, listen to him means listen to what he's just said. What he's just said is you can't, if you want to find your life, you've got to lose it. You've got to give it away to find it. All you mums and dads know that. You've got to give love to grow. You can't hold on to it and kind of stagnate and let it go sour. We have to give our life away for it to grow. That's what, how it works. So you've got to give your life. Listen to him. When the voice had spoken, here's the point, Jesus was found alone. The point of this story is you don't need the law and the prophets anymore. They're beautiful. They're helpful, heavens. Otherwise I wouldn't be spending my whole life studying them. But yes, but they can enrich your understanding. But everything is fulfilled in Jesus. See? He fulfills the Torah. It's all him. Moses leads to him. And once you've come to Jesus, you don't have to go back to Moses. And the prophets are all pointing to Jesus. Once you have Jesus, you don't have to go back to the prophets. Let them enrich your life. But keep your focus here in Jesus, who is the glory of God, the image of God, etc. So all of that is behind our text. Permanent in glory.